All day, I sat in my cell, just stressing, sitting back, reading my mail, reminiscing about the good times I had, trying to relive all the good memories I had. Hate the sound it makes when they close the gates. Wake up at 6 to eat nasty cornflakes. You ain't have a routine and your time is long. Work out, eat and sleep, now your time is gone. By the time I close my eyes to sleep at night, I thank the Lord that I could even sleep at night, cause I'm stressed. Gray hairs coming out my head. I'm trying to think, am I better off breathing today? Cause I'm stressed, I can't sleep at night. I'm in prison, I can't sleep at night. Man, it's making me stress. 23-hour lockdown sucks, cause they call you in the morning and you gotta get up. Play dice, old timers gonna teach you about life. Get religious, start reading about Christ. Pray to God, feels like I'm living in hell, but I'm stuck in a cell, hoping the CO don't...
And good morning, everybody. This is Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. My guest is on her way from Vancouver. Apparently, there's some serious traffic, not helped by the rain this morning. So we'll be getting in touch with Bronwyn Franklin as soon as she gets here. And she's going to be talking about mental health and prisons, which, of course, was the subject of that song by Continental Five, otherwise known as 2-5, with his song Stressed, which we had to drastically edit because of certain language considerations. But in that brief snippet, I think gives you perhaps a sense a bit more than, you know, one is able to get if one has never spent time, as I haven't, in prison. And a reality that is all too common in this country, especially for people of color and African Americans. And yeah, I'm going to read a few statistics while we're waiting for our guest. Anybody wants to call in who's got some direct experience, especially with the subject we're going to be talking about, we'd like to take your call at 503-231-8187. This show is the regular first Wednesday focus on mental health, struggles with stress, psychic instability, emotional turmoil, which we all go through, but some people have particularly acute and or chronic problems thereof. And we often interview the whoever's speaking at the Rethinking Psychiatry event, which is also on the first Wednesday of the month. And Bronwyn Franklin is going to be speaking this evening at the Montevilla United Methodist Church at 232 Southeast 80th Avenue here in Portland, starting at 7 p.m. Bronwyn, I might as well just introduce her. She has been a peer specialist and advocate for more than 10 years. She has a heart for social justice change in the prison justice system and supporting people to gain a better quality of life mentally, spiritually, and physically. She has a bachelor's degree in healthcare administration, as a native of Detroit, Michigan. She facilitates NAMI, which is the National Alliance on Mental Illness, peer-to-peer groups, and is a master trainer in the Living Well with Chronic Disease from Stanford. She's also the co-champion of the Trauma-Informed Systems Committee of the Oregon Consumer Advisory Council. She's going to be talking about what does being mentally altered look like in prison. She has had a direct personal experience with that. Who gets prison, who gets mental health treatment, and who gets real help? And there is hope with work. So while we're waiting for Bronwyn, as I said, I've got some statistics to throw at you from the Prison Reform Trust regarding mental health care in prisons. 26% of women and 16% of men said that they had received treatment for a mental health problem in the year before custody. 25% of women and 15% of men in prison reported symptoms indicative of psychosis. The rate among the general public is about 4%. Self-inflicted deaths are 8.6 times more likely in prison than the general public population. 70% of people who died from self-inflicted means whilst in prison had already been identified as having mental health needs. However, the Prisons and Probation Ombudsman found that concerns about mental health problems had only been flagged on entry to the prison for just over half of these people. The PPO, or Prisons and Probation Ombudsman's investigation, found that nearly one in five of those diagnosed with a mental health problem received no care from a mental health professional in prison. The PPO also found that no mental health referral was made when it should have been in 29% of self-inflicted deaths where mental health needs had already been identified. 40% of prisons inspected in 2016-17 had inadequate or no training for prison officers to know when to refer a person for mental health support. And of course, as we know, this parallels the issue of how our police deal with people with psychic distress. And as we know, our Portland police, since 2014, have been under a settlement agreement with the Department of Justice regarding their how they deal with such people, because of a series, an unending series, as it turns out, since there were, I believe, three out of the five people killed by the Portland police last year were in some form of mental distress or mental health crisis. And that they've now been found, the DOJ has now found the Portland police to be in substantial compliance with that settlement agreement that just came out a couple days ago. And in fact, I listened to Mayor Ted Wheeler and new police chief Jamie Resch on OPB's Think Out Loud yesterday talking about this very subject. And Dave Miller, the host, who I think is one of the better interviewers on radio, he did try to hold their feet to the fire, because they basically just wanted to say that, yes, they're in substantial compliance because they've revamped their training, their protocols, etc. They said, well, why were there more deaths than there have been since, I think, 2010, more police killings? And basically he wanted the new police chief, Jamie Resch, to step back and say, well, why did she think, since she's a longtime Portland police officer, she's risen through the ranks to become the new police chief, why she thought, despite the apparent, according to the DOJ and the Portland police themselves, the betterment of their practices, why there were still three police killings. And she basically danced around the question. And is it because of those particular officers are just have an entrenched way of responding to such situations that isn't amenable to retraining? Do they just have to wait for them to retire? I don't know. These are interesting questions. And while we wait for our guest, Bronwyn Franklin, who will be talking about all these issues, she's especially interested in, how the parallel, as I said, there's a parallel between how people undergoing especially acute psychic crises, how they're dealt with out in the, in public and open to the possibility of encounters with police, as we're talking about here, and how that happens in prison, which, as you can only imagine, is a much more, obviously, it's harder to hide in prison if you're going through, it's easier to be noticed, I guess, or maybe not. I don't know how things work in prison, but Anyway, she says that just like police in general aren't well trained to deal with these situations, prison guards are not well trained. As I think that I indicated with that last statistic, 40% in prisons inspected in 2016-17 had inadequate or no training for prison officers to know when to refer a prison for mental health support. So yeah, I mean, we have an economic system that is ultra competitive, doesn't allow much space for people in whatever form of crisis. The healthcare system is inadequate, woefully inadequate, including for mental health care. So people, it's, you know, not that difficult in this society for people to get into trouble of various kinds because of economic, personal, psychic issues, all often intertwined. And so people end up all too often now, because the history of the way that the society has dealt with people in psychic distress, that there is this basically a closing down of the large institutions, which didn't tend to treat people very badly, and they're supposed to be replaced by community-based mental health care, which never really happened. So what ended up is people ended up on the streets, people ended up burdening their loved ones and relatives and creating more stress in their lives and more economic burdens. And so we have a situation now, especially with the economic downturn in 2008, which led more and more people to end up on the streets. You have this perfect storm, as they say, of events where you have a massive homelessness problem, a massive mental health problem and health in general. And the way that the society, the kind of default way to solve it is a lot of people end up in jail or prison. And in jail and prison, there aren't the training and facilities and empathetic institutional culture, let us say, to deal adequately with people. So if you have anything to say about this, 503-231-8187. I just heard from Liam, my trusty board operator, that she has just walked in the door, so we can hear directly from her momentarily. So I was just talking about Portland Police Chief Mayor Wheeler, Mayor Ted Wheeler, and Portland Police Chief Jamie Resch, who are on the OPB show Think Out Loud, talking about the settlement agreement. So I don't know if you want to say anything about that, just to follow up before we get into your own personal history and the work you do in this area.
Thank you, Paul. Apologize for being late. I was listening to you on the way in, though. So, I have some thoughts around what is going on with the Portland Police Department at this time. I really think there's been some dancing around this issue for years, and I think things look well on paper to the DOJ, but as we know, and we've lived here, Portland police and the shootings that's occurring against people of color and especially people with mental health diagnosis, altered states is what I like to call them, is huge. When you have 3 out of 5 police shootings are people with mental health challenges, that's 3 too many. 5 police shootings is too many. And I think some of it is ingrained. I understand that the training has changed, and we're doing trainings, but I don't think it's enough. One thing is, when you're working with someone or you're trying to talk to someone who is having maybe some psychosis or some sort, for the lack of a better term, they may be hearing several voices and you're shouting commands at them and you're expecting them to, for the lack of a better term, comply. They're trying to figure out which voice to follow or how to focus. They're not processing what you're saying. They're not really hearing it. And you're getting frustrated because you don't understand this. You have not walked in their shoes. You don't know what that feels like to have all this going on inside your head at one time. And then someone yelling at you. You know, it's...
someone with a badge and a uniform who's
authority.
Probably sounding very, not very calm themselves.
Yes, they're not. They're not calm. They have authority, they have power, and they have a gun. And so now you don't know what to do. And that's why I think there's programs like Project Response, which is really great, because they send a mental health crisis worker with the police sometimes. People don't know that they can call and say, hey, this is a mental health crisis.
And that's here in
Portland.
Okay.
And they can request Project Respond to come out as well. I think Project Respond is underfunded. I think they need more therapists. They even have peer support on staff, you know, because sometimes people are in certain states, but they have certain needs as well, and these needs are not being met. So this is bringing about this behavior. You know, and it's like if we can drill down to what it is that a person needs, then we can support and help them better. So that's my thought on the police thing here. I hate to say this, but I also feel that there's ingrained bit of racism in our city. And that's not being addressed in the police station either, in that rank. And I had really strong feelings about some of the things that's transpiring in that police department at this point in time.
Well, we can talk about that more as we go along. I thank you for that, just to kind of give a sort of continuity with what I was talking about before. And I already did introduce you. Let me maybe just briefly
thank you.
Introduce you again. You're going to be, again, speaking this evening with the Rethinking Psychiatry's monthly event at the Montville United Methodist Church. That's at 232 Southeast 80th Avenue here in Portland, starting at 7 p.m. So you talked about the peer support. You are yourself a peer specialist and advocate for more than 10 years. And mm-hmm. you're especially interested in social justice change in the prison/justice or injustice system mm-hmm. and supporting people to gain a better quality of life mentally, spiritually, and physically. And you facilitate National Alliance for the Mentally Ill peer-to-peer support groups. So, and you're especially interested in this issue of people dealing with these issues in prison itself. That's what you're going to be talking about tonight.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So how, maybe start with, I know we've already got a caller, maybe I think it was Sean. If you could just hold on and let us get into this conversation, and then maybe in about, or maybe just call back, 503-231-8187 for everybody. That's maybe call back in about, you know, 10 minutes or so. So how did you get involved in this area?
So because of my own mental health instabilities, at one point in time, I had a very major crisis, and it resulted in me going to prison. I had no prior criminal record. I was gainfully employed. I was a homeowner and in a state of mania, which I I had undiagnosed mania. I committed an assault, and it was a severe tragedy.
So that, pardon me for asking, I've said this on this program before, but I also had a manic episode, so I know something about, I'm sure they're all different. I mean, you said it was undiagnosed. Had that been going on for a while?
Okay, so that kind of goes back into also the history of Black people and mental health. I had been diagnosed a long time as having major reoccurring depression. The mania had not been diagnosed because some of the behaviors with mania, with the lack of sleep, the irritability, and some of those other things that were happening had not been reported because I thought they were normal. This is what I seen in my home. This is what I seen in my neighborhood. This is how, so the behavior had not been reported. So it was not diagnosed. So I had been pretty much, as I know now, manic for about 4 months.
And it doesn't get better.
No.
That's the problem with it, yeah.
So sleep deprivation is another thing that will send you into psychosis and a lot of, so for 4 months, I really hadn't slept. You know, working a job, but not slept, taking care of my children, even though I was real irritable and cranky all the time and just suicidal. They said it was rapid cycling. So one minute I was suicidal, next minute I was homicidal. So, and it was like within seconds. So that's how I ended up in prison. And it was such a horrendous crime that the judge gave me 10 to 20. First time offender, had lawyers. However, I was a Black woman in my mid-30s, and he said, you should know better. Never took into account that this was a mental health, because in the 90s, they weren't looking at that. They weren't looking at trauma survivors. They weren't talking about that in the late 90s. So once I got to prison, I had been put on benzos in the county jail, which they helped, yeah. But then the jail says, no, you can't have those. We have to wean you off. This is a narcotic. Klonopin is a benzo. It's contraband. There was really no, and you spoke about this, the mental health providers in there are none. You know, you have a prison population of 2,000 or 3,000 women, and you have two social workers, not therapists, social workers. You have a prescriber that comes every 6 months and writes these scripts for medication. There's no mental health treatment. So after coming out of my days, I realized that I'm in a place where I don't want to be. I'm away from my children, the one thing in life I never wanted to be, away from my children. How did I get here, and what do I do to get out of this? So basically, I started working on figuring that out, and there was not a lot of help I had. The mental health people came and went. It was a revolving door. I've seen one lady twice, but some questions that she asked me changed the way I thought and enlighten me of who I was, to see myself as no longer a victim, but being more of a victor and using my strengths, which is what we do in peer support. We help people identify what their strengths are so that they can use their strengths to have a better quality of life.
And if it just strikes me, though, that it almost, the way you're describing it, almost seems somewhat random that this is one person who happened to be there at the right time for you. Maybe there wouldn't have been that right person, you know, maybe it wouldn't have taken you another year or 2 years or who knows, right?
Yeah, I agree. It was really random because at that time I was in such a fog, I can't remember this lady's name, you know, because I only seen her twice. So it was no one I had really built up a relationship with. You know, I met with her individually twice and we had a group session once. That was it. And she was gone, you know, and
this is pretty much the rule. I guess I'll just jump forward. Since you are working in this field, maybe we can, you know, jump back to your story as we go, but have things substantially changed since then?
No, it's pretty much the same, because people in this field of work are underpaid, overworked, and undervalued. And people are constantly moving on to the next best thing, you know. And it's not because they don't care. It's not that they don't have a heart for it. But they have to pay their bills. And so they're moving on to the next best thing. So I've seen the cycle, and I think that frustrates a lot of people with mental health challenges, because as soon as you build a relationship with someone, they're gone. They're moving on to the next place. And then you re-traumatize yourself by telling your story over again to the next person. And then people wonder why, when you come in to see the therapist or counselor or whoever, you're angry. You seem like you're bitter. You seem a little hostile. Because here, I have to tell my story again to someone new who's not going to be here long. And that's frustrating.
It takes a lot of energy to do that, yeah.
Yes, you know, because that's not helping me work through it. It's just helping me relive the trauma instead of helping me work through it.
So, let's just, I guess Sean is still on the line. Let's hear what Sean has to say. Go ahead, Sean.
Hey, good morning. I'm calling the same reason I called last week when Paul had a guy talking about Wall Street corruption. And that is this whole concept of normalizing abuse. So like in any abusive relationship, you have flagrant, over-the-top mistreatment, and the victim is supposed to just kind of accept that and become fatalistic and hopeless. I'm wondering this morning, what are the possibilities that mental health professionals might lead the revolution? And I say that because you had teachers in Oklahoma, you had teachers in West Virginia, you know, they had no union approval. They just went out on wildcat strikes. They literally walked out. I'm wondering, what are the possibilities that, like, in a kind of liberation psychology model, the mental health professionals one day are just going to finally say, enough is enough. We've seen there's no intellectual legitimacy to this. There's no ethical legitimacy to this. We are simply walking off the job because we will not look another client in the face and see this neglect and abuse go on and on and on. In the wealthiest country in the world, you know, the jails and the prisons becoming our de facto treatment centers. It is just a travesty. We're not going to have it anymore, and we're just going to walk out. So I'll stop there. Thanks.
Wow. Thank you, Sean. You said a lot. I think part of I think that's a wonderful idea that we all just rise up as mental health professionals and say, hey, enough is enough. However, I think a lot of the mental health professionals are trained in a certain way. And the way they're trained, and we call it the clinical model, and they're trained to tell people what they need, tell people what they want. And sometimes they don't recognize that we're human and we have different needs and we have different wants, and allow us the opportunity to say what it is that we feel we need or say what we want. They come at us and they're trained that they know better because they have this degree. And that's what peer support does, just the opposite. And that's why peer support has been effective in my life and so many other lives, is because we come alongside of people and we ask them, what's their strengths? What is it they want? And hey, how can I support you and walk alongside of you to get there? Whereas when you go into a typical therapist's office, they sit there, they may assess the situation, but then they're going to say, well, let's do this, or let's do that, or let's do that. That might not be what I need to do. First, let's identify my strengths, because I may have already done that. You know, I may have already tried that. You know, help me learn some other tools. So you got a great point, but it's about the way our clinical providers are already thinking and how they're trained, you know. And speaking of training, And Paul alluded to this earlier about correctional officers. Correctional officers come in and all they need is a high school diploma. They have no other training or any other idea about mental health. They have no trauma training. They have no way of assessing it. I think as an inmate, as a prisoner, and a person with lived experience was able to recognize things before the officers were, you know. And a lot of times when things would occur, the sad part about it is other inmates would come get me before they go get the CO. Because it was something about my calming voice, being able to talk to people and being able to get them to see it from a different perspective, you know, just talking to them and giving them different examples to look at.
So you basically were already sort of doing informal peer support in prison, in a sense, yeah?
The sad part about it is I've been doing it all my life. I just didn't know that's what it was. And then I got in there and...
That's what people say that women do in our culture.
Yeah, it's kind of natural, nurturing type thing as women. I was a nurturer. I was a caregiver. And I learned how to take the rough situations and... see them from a different perspective and help other people where there was not a lot of panic or, you know, people being upset and just dysregulated.
But there are no, we were talking about this earlier, that there is no formal peer support as we know it, as it's come to, which is a relatively recent thing as it is. It basically came out of the 60s, 70s psychiatric survivors movement, people who saw that the system was not working and who stepped into the breach and offered their own personal experience in directly helping and also further than that, like I think you do, is actually working with the institutions that are working with people with altered states or mental illness or psychic distress or whatever. And so there's a whole peer support movement around the country and, of course, here in Oregon that you're a part of. But that hasn't actually reached into the prisons. Is that right?
As far as I know, it has not really reached into the prisons officially. There are some people that go in and do mentorship through things such as ministry, religious ministries, or NAAA type groupings, but actual, and then I've been in there a couple of times to just speak to people that are getting ready to re-enter, and they got a group setting going on.
Visit people, yeah.
Yes, and that's questionable because in Michigan, where I'm originally from, being that I am a felon, I can't go into the prison and visit another felon. I can't go into the prison and do any type of work. You know, here it's a little different. And because I work in the mental health field, I was able to get clearance to go in and speak to groups. I've not been in there and spoke to people one-on-one.
Just seems so ass backwards.
It really is. It really is.
In terms of, you know, help, you know, offering, you know, your lived experience, you know, the fact that you were a felon is part of your lived experience. It can be helpful. I mean, I can see that there's security concerns, all that, but it seems like all that can be, those are just bureaucratic obstacles.
It is, and I think a lot of it, I think recidivism is huge, and it keeps the prison funded. Because every time you come back, they get a lump sum of money for the year. So it's nice to keep you coming back, you know. So why would I put things in place that's going to help you learn how to not come back and improve your life? So as all these things were coming up for me this week, the Rethinking Psychiatry, the interview here, I realized tomorrow is February 6th. And that will be the 13th year anniversary of me actually walking out of the prison. Hmm. February 6, 2007.
Congratulations.
And it is the tools that I put together and trying to figure out how to make them work once I stepped out those doors. There, no one helped me do that. When I was released, because I had a mental health diagnosis, they sent me to adult foster care and said, go sign up for Social Security because you'll never work. This is your life.
That's exactly parallel to what they used to, I hope they don't as much or anymore, tell people with serious, you know, acute mental health issues. They used to, that's what they would tell people, and get them on drugs. And of course, that becomes a self-reinforcing thing. Anyway, please continue. Sorry.
No. So back to what, you know, Sean was saying, here it is again. They're telling me what's good for me, who I am. I'm broken. This is what you do. Okay. They kept me 6 months longer because just before I was to see the parole board, my son was murdered. So they kept me 6 months longer than they were supposed to because they wanted to monitor my mental health. Because
instead of going back to your family and dealing with it.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. The trauma that's put on people in prison is ridiculous, you know, and it's out of ignorance. So when my son was murdered, yes, I was allowed to go to a special viewing, which only people that was on my visit list could be there. But they took me in there with wrist chains and ankle chains because he was 21 years old. And we're scared. We're going to a rough part of Detroit, and we're scared. However, when my mother passed away, they didn't shackle me like that. It was altogether different, and it comes out of having some empathy, having some compassion, some common sense, that this is a person that's grieving. You know, but I'm 3 months from coming home from prison, and you got me in all these chains. How traumatic was that for my family to see me come in there all chained up where I could barely walk? But they don't know any better, and they have not changed this prison system in hundreds of years. And now the prisons have become de facto mental health units. We have more people with mental health crisis or mental health concerns in prisons than we do in state hospitals.
So let me just jump to this question that you're going to talk about once again tonight at the Montville United Methodist Church as part of the Rethinking Psychiatry monthly events every first Wednesday of the month. That's at 232 Southeast 80th Avenue to hear Bronwyn Franklin, my guest this morning. So you're going to be talking about what is being mentally altered look like in prison. You've already talked some about that, but want to go a little more into that?
Yes.
By the way, people can call in 503-231-8187.
So for me, it was different. Once I got stable, and yes, I lined up every day to take my medication because that was required, you know, to line up every day in this line and take my medication.
But you said they wouldn't allow that other...
Yeah, they took me off of that and put me on Zoloft. But that was it.
So you have a list of like approved medications for prison?
Yes, that you can get, and certain ones you cannot get. But then you have a ward where they keep people who have mental health challenges and behaviors are concerning, and they consider them to be unsafe. So here you have a place where you're already in a prison, which is isolation. And then you have a separate unit with another fence around it that you keep the people that you feel are mentally unsafe in that unit. And then you keep them in that unit locked down 23 hours a day.
And without an actual support staff to help them?
No, not at all. And all you do is they're locked in their cell, so there's more isolation. So they're isolated triple time because prison is isolation. Then you're in a unit that's isolated from the general population. Then you're isolated in that unit in your cell with nothing to do, no one to talk to, and you're getting your meals passed through, you're getting your meds passed through. You do nothing all day.
So are people like acting out? Are people like screaming, crying? Is it?
They're so medicated, they're not doing anything. Oh, they okay, can't okay. function.
Yeah.
You know,
that's how they handle that problem.
Yes, because they feel like you're unsafe for yourself, you're unsafe for other inmates, and you're unsafe for the COs. So they keep them highly medicated. They let them outside once a day to get on the yard. If you're a smoker, you might get to go out if the CO lets you, you know, to smoke your cigarettes, you know. And then when they figure you're calm enough, they bring you back to general population. But once you're back in general population, you've been isolated so long, you really don't know how to function. And then that's traumatizing you. That's triggering some traumas. When I was there, I had a lady who had been spent 2 years in that unit, and they eventually moved her into the same cell with me and my other roommate. She had all types of things going on. She didn't sleep. She sat on the side of the bed all night. She drank coffee. She was in and out of her locker, checking her stuff, you know, because she was still clearly having some paranoid things going on, maybe some other things going on, you know. They had not done anything but aspirated her condition. And then once she got medication compliant and calm, put her back in general population, you know, which made her a target as well.
Oh, does that happen? So people...
People prey on people,
and but I mean specifically people who've been in the who are known to have
people
mental
prey.
Issues. Yeah,
people on our streets, our homeless that have mental health crisis are more vulnerable to be victims than they are to be the aggressors. We're more docile, and if you got somebody on a lot of medication, you know, that's barely functioning, they become prey. And this lady, you know, basically, I watch people wheel and deal all the time to get her stuff, you know. But she was at a point where she didn't listen. You know, we could talk to her, but she would get upset because she thought that these were her friends. You know, but she had been locked into a unit for 2 years. So anybody that showed her any kindness and listen to her were her friends, because nobody had listened to her and she hadn't had a conversation in 2 years.
So let's jump to Oregon in 2020. And I know you're the co-champion of the Trauma Informed Systems Committee of the Oregon Consumer Advisory Council. Now, there's issues across the board. There's issues with the Unity Center, which was this whole new center to deal with people undergoing, you know, immediate crisis to avoid, hopefully, that they either go to jail or have to go to the state hospital or whatever. Now there's problems there. There's problems with funding across the board. So I know there's talk about getting more funding for behavioral unit or something in the prison system. Talk about what you're doing with the Oregon Consumer Advisory Council and talk about what's going on in Oregon prisons right now.
So a little correction. I am no longer the co-champion of that committee, but I still sit on that committee. So we've talked about this as a Consumer Advisory Council, and the sad part about it is what we do as a council is we advise OHA, okay, which
Oregon
is the
Oregon
Health Authority. We advise them. However, anything that's doing with the prison population is not under the Oregon Health Authority. So we have no say-so in making any recommendations or any advice to the powers that be over the prison system. We can't do it. We're just out of it. And we went around for a couple of years trying to figure out what we could do about that, because again, that's kind of my passion. So some of the things that we have talked about in the trauma-informed system is we really wanted to be able to look at some of the site reviews. Oregon State Hospital has a internal site review where they're looking at their trauma policies and how they handle things. And we have been asking and requesting possible that we adopt their model for all of the psychiatric programs and residential type programs across the state, and allow peer providers to go in there to be able to do the peer the do the actual site review and talk to the actual residents. Right now we're talking with,
which of course is completely separate from the prison, so these are kind of parallel things. Or,
yeah. Right, you know, but it's like, where can we, yeah, we need to set precedent somewhere, start a model somewhere. DLJ kind of came in and said, we need more information because we have a problem with mental health people going in and interviewing other mental health people. They couldn't wrap their head around peer support people going in and interviewing people in residential settings for site reviews. It was over their head.
A problem of accreditation or...
No, it was, they felt that it was a lot of different violations, maybe even a HIPAA violation and this and that, you know. So right now we're going back and forth with some communication with them, trying to figure out how can we get this done, because even in the hospital settings and the Unity settings and all these different settings, there needs to be some reform. There needs to be some things looked at. We need to have more peer support doing pure peer work and not being co-opted as clinical, many clinicians. Allow us to go in there and
peer support basically means also being an advocate, which is often why the institutions don't sort of resist.
Yes, yes. Because, yes, absolutely. Being a peer support is... If this doesn't feel right to me, I'm going to let you know that this. I'm going to ask my person, how does this feel for them? And if they're saying this doesn't feel right for them, or this is what they want, then part of what I do is say, hey, this is what they want. This doesn't feel right. Can we move around and do something different? Again, it's going against, I know better than you what you need. And that's and peer support is like the opposite of that. So yeah, it's a pushback. When you say you want to put peer support in something, okay, you're going to shake this up and we don't want to change.
They just don't want outside eyes, informed outside eyes looking at what's going on. True. Well, we got a caller. Stuart is on the line. Go ahead, Stuart.
Hey. Your topic is just, it's excellent, and it's so good to hear you guys talking about this, and I was kind of waiting for you guys to kind of jump into what are we going to do now, you know, and I totally agree with the advocation and, you know, the support groups, and something's got to be done, because like the outside eyes don't see what goes on in there, and God knows, you know. So yeah, keep up the good work. It's a very good conversation, and I wish you the best, and keep it up. That's all I gotta say. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and Stuart, please feel free to come out to the Montevilli United Methodist Church this evening. You can meet like-minded people and meet Bronwyn, and that's the way these things happen. people make connections.
Yeah, thank you, Stuart. You had a question, what do we do next? And that's an excellent question. And that's what's on my mind is, what do we do next? And I think we need more advocates on prison reform to go in there and talk about the trauma training that needs to go on with our officers. Crisis intervention, trauma training, peer supports going in there and being able to mentor with people who are in the prison and helping them make that transition to reentry into society and continuing to walk along with them, maybe 6 months to a year before they're released, to 6 months to a year after, being able to walk along and advocate with them and teaching them to advocate for themselves. That's what I see being next. Better assessments, going in and assessing people's needs before you send them to prison and seeing if there's some trauma stuff going on and how do we help not activate this trauma stuff. I see these are things that I see would be helpful.
Looks like we got another caller. Anne, if you're still on the line, please join the conversation.
Good morning. I wanted to thank the speaker very much. I think you're doing such an excellent job and wonderful work. And I wanted to just affirm what you were saying about isolation. Back in the 1970s, I had paranoid delusions and a psychosis, and I continued to work. Now, the reason I did was I was terrified to go to the psychiatric community because my uncle was institutionalized for a lifetime after he was 16, and I didn't want that to happen to me, and I didn't know what was happening to me. I had therapy from social workers. They charged $25 a session in those days, and they were very kind to me. In any case, I managed to work because I was a transcriber plugged into earphones, and I was in a radiation therapy department. I worked my way through that period, and after that, I had major depressive disorder for 15 or more years, which was treated eventually with Prozac. And I didn't have any suicidal ideation after that. But I spent 15 years with that kind of ideation because I was terrified of the psychiatric community. And I just have to say that isolating people is the worst thing anybody can do to them. If they have a safe, loving environment, their chances of recovery and of living a normal life are so much better. So I just wanted to reaffirm from the other end of the stories, because I realized you've been telling the isolation stories, and I wanted to tell a story that was not about the isolation, but about having a place to go, people who knew me. They didn't know exactly what was happening, but they knew something was happening, and they worked with me anyway. And I just wanted to once again say thank you so much. This is such an important message, and you're doing wonderful work. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. And to kind of piggyback in is last year, we were pushing this thing for peer-run respites. And I presented at Rethinking Psychiatry. You can pull up the video about that. Respites, again, having a safe place for a person to go that's experiencing what you were experiencing, being with peer support, and being able to stay, having the option to leave if you wanted to, but having that safe place and not being isolated. And we pushed it, and we took it all the way. And I have to give a shout out, if I can, to Kevin Fitz. He pushed it all the way to the legislation, but we fell a little short. We're going to keep pushing that, because peer-run respites would be great here in Oregon or any state where people can go when they're having trouble and not have to go through it alone.
Which goes back to the kind of the origins of the peer support movement, from what I understand, was, I guess they called them freak out centers or whatever, where people had a safe place to go to do whatever they needed to do to partly just to get stuff out of the system, but especially to have people there who understood them and, you know, just let them alone to go through what they needed to go through. And that was, you know, that would have been part, a main component of these community-based mental health services, which were supposed to take the place of the large institutions when they mainly closed down and never really, and the funding never appeared. Now people are still fighting mm-hmm. for that funding to establish that kind of.
Absolutely, absolutely. So yeah, those are things I think people need. Community, people need safe places, but we also need some transparency. And just to go all the way back to what we talked about earlier when we were talking about the mayor and the police chief on the radio, there was no transparency. And when we have no transparency, we have no trust. How can we trust you when you're ringing a circle around the topic and not hitting it direct on? You know, and you're not being transparent about what's really going on. So safety and transparency is huge.
And accountability. I mean,
yes.
You know, the person who shot the live round and killed that man most recently, you know, in December, you know, I don't know. I don't know who it is. I don't want to make, you know, irresponsible accusations, you know, whether there's someone who just, you know, maybe they had their own issue with, you know, people undergoing crisis, who knows, you know, but whatever, they did something that didn't need to happen, in my estimation. Then there's never accountability. They were already cleared, and that happens time and all across the country, mm-hmm. whether it's shooting African Americans, mm-hmm. which happens, as you know, all too depressingly frequently all over the place, including mm-hmm. in Portland. Whether it's, you know, now there's a big focus on people undergoing mental health crises because they're so out there in the public because there's no help, which is what, you know, Wheeler rightfully has been talking about, that the system, but that doesn't excuse the Portland police.
No,
doesn't excuse it, or the mistreatment at the hands of prison guards who don't undergo the training.
Absolutely. They have not been trained. It's not their fault. You know, our government needs to do better in training our people.
Well, we are all out of time. I just realized as I see, look at the clock.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Bronwyn. And people can see you tonight again at 232 Southeast 80th Avenue here in Portland at 7 p.m.
Yeah, absolutely. Look forward to it. Thank you. All right.